This is a University of Otago podcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wonderful to see you here tonight. My name's Peter Joyce and I'm Dean, University of Otago, Christchurch. Tonight's lecture is the fifth in a series of seven public lectures that we're doing this year. And this year, all seven of these lectures are also inaugural professorial lectures, which is a tradition within the university for people either being appointed or promoted to a position of professor within the university. Tonight's speaker is Professor Andrew Day. Now, Andrew did his medical training through the University of Otago, trained in paediatrics in New Zealand and particularly in Christchurch. As many paediatricians do, he spent 3 years in Toronto at the Children's Hospital in Toronto and then worked in Sydney for 10 years. But he could no longer back the Waratahs or the Wallabies, so needed to come back to New Zealand. And Andrew came back in 2009, and in 2012 he was promoted to Professor of Paediatrics. And tonight he's going to be talking about the battle of the gut, which I suspect is something to do with inflammatory bowel disease in children in particular, but I'm sure Andrew will outline that much better than I can. Andrew.
Good evening. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, everybody. What I'm going to talk about tonight is a little bit about the bowel, a bit about the bugs, and a bit about some battles that can happen between the bugs and the bowel. We're going to talk about what the bowel is, what happens there. We're going to introduce you to some of the players in terms of the bugs. And we're going to talk about some examples of battles that can happen. I am going to present some data and we'll try and go through that slowly. I won't be able to cover everything, but we'll give you a highlight in terms of some of the key things, particularly as they stand at the moment in this area. First, looking at the past, Hippocrates was said to have said that death sits in the bowels, but also that bad digestion is the root of all evil. And he was obviously pretty focused upon the bowels being central to what we do and to how things go. Over the millennia since then, we're now looking to explore Mars, we're looking to explore the solar system, but over the last few years, there's also been a whole lot of work looking at the interior of us as well, looking at what's called the human gut microbiome, or the bugs that live inside us. Let's move into the bowels. We're just going to take a pictorial journey through the bowels. We're going to move through the esophagus into the stomach, round the mass of the small bowel, into the large bowel. We're going to bypass the little flower. So this is the esophagus moving down, so moving things from the back of the mouth down to the stomach. There's a picture of the stomach, so moving things, churning things, moving things through into the small bowel. This is a picture in the middle part of the small bowel, the jejunum. And then moving through into the large bowel, and this is where the appendix sits, just in this little fold here, for those that still have their appendix. And then moving on through the large bowel, and this is the middle section, the transverse colon, towards the end, the rectum, and then out the other end. But this is a factory. A whole lot of things happen here. It's not just a tube with things moving through. A whole lot of things happen, and I'm not going to go through all the detail on this slide, don't worry. But this is a factory. There's a whole lot of digestion. There's a whole lot of absorption of fats, proteins, carbohydrates, micronutrients, and parts of this gut are specialised in terms of absorbing iron here, absorbing B12 down here, absorbing folate. Each of the parts is specialised, each of them does lots of different jobs. Even this part down here, the large bowel, absorbs some water, absorbs some nutrients, and also absorbs some of the bile acids. In addition, there's a whole lot of residents inside the bowel, and maybe around 100 trillion. So bugs, bugs, and more bugs. It's estimated that most of us have between 1 and 2 kilograms of bacterial cells, 10 to the 13, so 1 with 13 zeros, compared to 10 to the 12 cells that we have in our body. So 10 times as many cells live within inside us compared to what we're made up of. And each of us has a slightly different variation on the profile of those bacteria. The stool or the bacteria could be seen a little bit like the sea, and I'm going to use a few analogies tonight, and this is just one of them. So we can imagine the sea, the waves crashing on the shore, and if we look at the sea from where we are, we can see the top. Over time, we've had different machines and so on that have been able to explore the sea and to understand the sea a bit more. And this is a little bit like the stool, a little bit like the flora. We've seen the surface for a while. Now we're starting to understand there's a whole new world in there, and it's a really important world that affects all of us in different ways. Again, going back in history for a moment, so in medieval times, the look, the smell, the texture of the stool was the way they defined things. Just over 100 years ago, 130 years ago, microorganisms started to be cultured. And then 30-odd years ago, we started to use molecular tools, and one of those is called PCR, or polymerase chain reaction, which means that we can look at the DNA of the bacteria without having to culture them. And over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a whole new spectrum, a whole new series of tools that have looked at the molecular pattern of the stool, of the bacteria, and mean that we can get a whole lot more information about what's actually happening. And we'll touch on some of these techniques a little bit as we go through. There's probably 500 species at least, but 30 or 40 of those species account for the majority of the bugs that we have. If we culture them, if we grow them in the laboratory on a plate, we can probably only get about 10 or 20% of those, and the rest are considered unculturable, and it's those molecular tools, the DNA, the interior part of the bacteria, if you like, that we can use to identify those non-culturable bacteria. So who are some of the bugs? They can be divided into different categories, and this is just to mention some of the phyla, some of the broader groups of bacteria. There's the Firmicutes, the Bacteroidetes, the Proteobacteria, and Actinobacteria. This is just an example of one of the molecular tools that we can use. This is called denaturing gel gradient electrophoresis. So we isolate the DNA from some stool, in this case. We put it on an electrophoresis panel, and there's a gradient of urea and formamide down here, and then we can get each of these little bars is a group of bacteria, a section of bacteria, and we can look at the diversity, look at the banding pattern to understand a little bit about the stool in this case. And this can give a little bit similar to a fingerprint, so each person's DGGE is slightly differently reflecting the flora that we have. But the big tool that we've developed, or that's been developed over the last years, is using the ribosomal RNA, so this particular component in the bacteria that is even more of a fingerprint because it's individual from bacteria to bacteria. And this is what the 454 sequencing or the high throughput sequencing or other techniques has been using in terms of identifying bacteria more. Some of those techniques include phage libraries, but that involves a huge amount of work even just to identify a few samples. But it's the 454 sequencing and the high throughput sequencing that's transformed this by getting a whole lot of reads, hundreds of thousands of reads from a single sample, and that's evolved over the last 5 or 6 years. And just to illustrate some of the scientific interest, this is a plot, this was up to 2010, but this indicates the number of scientific publications relating to the flora. And you can see that from the turn of the decade, this has taken off. So that the scientific community is very, very excited in terms of looking further at the stool, looking at the bacteria, and understanding that more and how it translates to specific outcomes or specific diseases. Just an example of two of the outputs of this, one publication from the year before last looked at individual samples. They did the high throughput sequencing, and they identified what they've called enterotypes. So they had 39 samples from people in different parts of the world, characterised them molecularly, and identified that people fell into three different groups. And that was a little bit regardless of where they came from in the world, either the country or the continent. And this just illustrates some of their results. This is divided in terms of the enterotype. So enterotype 1 has a predominance of Bacteroidetes and a little bit of Rhizomyococcus, but not much of this guy. and the other enterotypes differ in terms of their patterns of the flora. So they were able to illustrate that this didn't matter where you came in the world, people fell into one of these three patterns. And they also identified that people responded differently to diet, to drugs, to other things that might change the flora, depending on the balance between the flora in their individual enterotype. Another group, also in the same year, looked at slightly more people, 98 individuals. Their data suggested that two of those enterotypes were major and more significant, and one of them wasn't. But they clearly also showed that these enterotypes were linked in with diet. And for example, enterotype 1 was associated with a high-fat, low-fibre diet. And in addition, those enterotypes linked in with BMI, so obesity in terms of the body mass index. So we've probably always said that a common saying, we are what we eat, but it's very clear from the data that's emerging that our bugs reflect what we eat as well. And that's characterised in terms of those enterotypes, in terms of that data, but a whole lot of other data as well. Looking a little bit in terms of the development of the flora, I'll just go through these parts in turn. This looks through the gut from the stomach to the colon, and you can see there's a few bugs in the stomach, but there's a whole heap in the colon, and progressively more as we move through the gut. So where you are in the gut distinguishes what sort of bacteria might be there and how many bacteria are there. If we look at the lining of the gut, we have the epithelium, which are the lining cells or the epithelial cells that go along the surface of the bowel. Some bugs live close to the surface or live in the mucus, and other bugs live in the lumen, in the middle part, away from the edge. So different bugs suiting different environments within the gut. In addition, it's clear that our flora evolves as we grow. We're essentially thought to be sterile when we're born in terms of no bacteria. That's probably a simplification. But depending on what our mother has, what we eat early in life, other environmental exposures, antimicrobial, antibiotic exposures, we develop our flora differently. And probably from about 1 or 2 years of age, the number are pretty well established, but the flora can change depending on what we eat, depending on other things that might happen a long time. So there's a whole lot of intricacies in terms of how these guys, where they live, how they work, and how they interact. This is some data that we have looking at early in life. So this is comparing what happens in the flora using that DGGE technique I mentioned earlier, and looking at the diversity, so how many different types of bacteria are present. First of all, in some term babies, so babies that are born at the right time of life, and then some preterm babies that were born prematurely. And the key thing is, this is the term babies. Very quickly, term babies establish the flora. They get big diversity, more and more bugs. Whereas the preterm babies down here take a long time to establish their flora. They build up the range and the diversity of the flora much more slowly than the babies are born at the correct time, reflecting a whole lot of things that happen early in life in the premature infant, such as antibiotics, such as different feeding patterns, and so on. This is from the same study. We looked at the bifidobacterium, so a particular species of bacteria, or especially group of bacteria. This is the time period. And these hashed bars are the term babies, and this little checkered one is the preterm baby. So very quickly, term babies acquire this bifidobacteria, most likely following on from breast milk as a key way to grow this bacteria or to foster this bacteria. But the preterm babies take at least 2 months before they started to get this organism. So early life events, prematurity, other things that happen in life, predict or guide how we develop this flora early on. And in our modern life, there's a whole lot of things that have changed from the 1800s or the 1700s that reflect what our flora is like now. And some of these events may well change the flora in such a way that it opens us up to a whole new range of diseases, and we'll touch on some of those later. Going through these, clean water. We take clean water for granted. Maybe not in February 2 years ago, but we take clean water for granted in terms of a way to when there's not clean water, increased movement of bacteria as a between people that way. Increases cesarean sections, changes the way babies, whether they're preterm or term, get exposed to the bacteria. Similarly, increased use of antibiotics prior to birth, changing the bugs in the vagina, changing through the birth canal, and changing the way that babies acquire those antibiotics. Breastfeeding is a very important thing in terms of changing or the development of the flora. Smaller family size means we transmit bugs less between us because there's less of us in the same house. Similarly, antibiotics change the flora, and we'll see some other comments about that later. Increased bathing, the antibacterial soaps and the spray and wipes and whatever that we see on TV every day change the flora in a particular way that may well be another factor that opens us up to new problems. Even dental fillings is another way that can change the patterns of the flora. These little guys here, they live in the dirt, they get exposed to bugs early, and there's a number of studies showing that this sort of pattern of existence is very important in terms of getting healthy bugs early, priming the immune system, leading to a whole lot of protective factors, and as per the saying, beating disease. So what do our bugs do for us? There's a whole trillions of bugs there. Do they actually do anything for us? And it's very clear that they do a whole lot of things for us. We'd be lost without them, if you like. Just to illustrate some broad categories, I'm not going to talk about each of these in turn. They relate to a number of behavioural aspects, anxiety, pain perception. They affect a whole lot of things in the gut. Obviously, that's where they live, so that's not too surprising. They affect the bones in a whole lot of different ways in terms of bone health. They affect vessel formation around the gut, and they affect metabolism in a whole lot of different ways as well. And you'll see adiposity there, or obesity by another term, and we'll get back to talk about obesity towards the end as well, because it's clear that bacteria have a role in that. Some more functions. They make biotin, they make folate, which we can then absorb. They help the absorption of some electrolytes, such as calcium and magnesium. They break down some compounds that might otherwise lead to cancer. And very importantly, as per the pigs, they help to train the immune system and prompt the development of the immune system towards a beneficial way. They're also important in terms of digestion of unutilized nutrients and carbohydrates as an example, and we'll touch on that in a little bit more detail. There's a number of sugars or carbohydrates that we just can't digest, we just can't break down. They include starches, fibres, different sugars, but bacteria are able to ferment them, making wine, like making wine or making beer. And one of the products of that is the short-chain fatty acids, butyrate and others. And those guys are very important in terms of the lining cells of the colon. Without the butyrate, without the short-chain fatty acids, those lining cells of the gut don't thrive, they don't work properly, and they don't grow properly. So, again, another important role in terms of bacteria. Another role that the bacteria living in us have all the time is stopping invaders. I'm just going to mention Clostridium difficile, and some people may know about C. diff. So this is the concept of colonization resistance, and just through the concepts really, not the details. As we've just said, there's a whole lot of flora there to begin with, and they're very good at protecting their own patch from invaders. There's a whole lot of different mechanisms that they use, quorum sensing and so on, to make sure that nobody else comes along and steals their little patch of the bowel. Antibiotics, maybe for a chest infection or whatever, can upset that protection. And that leads to the development of Clostridium difficile and antibiotic-associated diarrhoea more broadly. This is C. diff, this organism here. And this graph is in some American data, and this is just to illustrate what's happening with C. diff over the last 10 years. This green line is the number of cases, and you can see that over the last decade it's tripled, three times more cases of C. diff. This is, as I said, it's American data, not New Zealand data. This red line is the number of people that have died from their C. diff. And you can see that that's gone from 5 to 25 per million population. So five times as many people dying from this bug as a consequence of the disruption of the flora. And obviously antibiotic prescribing and antibiotic choices come into this as well. But perhaps there's other things in terms of how the bugs work together and the way the bugs have changed from other environmental factors that make this more likely. So this is usually a happy place in the bell. There's a good balance between those friendly bugs that we need for all sorts of metabolic things and ourselves. We wouldn't, as I said, we wouldn't survive without the bugs. But what happens if it all goes wrong? What might lead to disease? What sort of bad bugs or bad things could happen? So we're just going to move analogies for a moment and we're going to prepare for battle. So we have lots of defences. If we move back to medieval times again, we've got a castle wall defending ourselves from the invaders coming from across the sea. We've got the little guys with the crossbows protecting from the castle wall, getting ready to repel the invaders. Or, as per a border crossing in Kazakhstan, we have borders that help to keep the inside in and the outside out. And just like those things, there's a whole lot of things that we have in our gut that are really important in terms of keeping the bacteria where they should be and stopping the consequences of imbalance or bad bugs causing problems. And again, I'll just go through, this is some of these. Gastric acid. Acid is very important in terms of being a barrier that bugs that we ingest, let's say it's salmonella or campylobacter from something we've eaten at a barbecue the other day, they have to get through the acid environment first. And acid's not many bugs like acid. Mucus. There's a whole lot of cells right through the gut that secrete mucus. They make mucus. It's their job. It's their day-and-day job. And mucus forms a barrier on the top of the lining cells that many bugs can't get through. Motility. So that's the motor action in the gut. What moves things through, moves that bolus of food and so on through the gut. If things are moving in a forward direction, then any invader there might get repelled or pushed out the other end in due course. If there's no motility, if things hang around, there's more time, if you like, for those bugs to cause chaos. The lining cells themselves, the epithelial cells, they form a barrier. It's like the border guards, if you like, that little barrier in Kazakhstan. It's the same principle in terms of keeping things out. The connections between the cells are really important in terms of the what's called permeability. And there's a whole lot of physiology that relates to that, but tight junctions are the junctions between the cells that stops things sneaking between. If they've lost those connections, things are more permeable. Bugs or products of bugs can get in underneath those lining cells. There's a whole series of antibacterial proteins that are secreted and made in the lining cells, secreted into the lumen, into the bowel, that get rid of bad bugs, if you like. And there's defensins, there's cathelicidins, and these proteins exist right through monkeys and animals of different sorts as well as humans. There's a whole system of receptors, if you like, on the lining cells of the gut that pick up bad bugs. The pathogen recognition systems and toll-like receptors are some of those. And there's a whole series of these proteins, of these molecules that sit on the cells and recognise a bad bug or a particular breakdown product of a bad bug and then mount a response. And then there's the immune responses that we like making antibodies or the other white cells that come along and mop things up as well. So all these components go towards keeping the bugs in the right place and stopping them coming into the body and causing chaos. We've had some interest recently in a protein called CCAM6. And CCAM6 is one of a family of proteins. There's only eight of the family here, but there's a whole series of cousins and brothers and sisters as well. And CCAM6 is this little guy here. It sits on the outside of cells, and it's a receptor for particular proteins. And we've shown, this is an immunofluorescence, this green guy here is the CCAM6. These are the cells that are stimulated by a nutritional stimulus and or with a particular type of cytokine or a particular defense protein. And we can show that we can increase the amount of CCAM6 that's present. Some people may be duck shooters and they know all about decoy ducks. This is Decoy Roy, who's a musical singing duck, I understand. And CCAM6 is a bit like Decoy Roy. We think that it acts as a decoy. So it's expressed on the lining cells of the gut, but it's also squirted into the insides here, where it binds to bacteria and stops the bacteria getting to the cells. And then it gets cast out with the rest of the things that go through the bowel. And our initial data suggests that this is one of the things that CCAM 6 might be doing. And this is another aspect of the defence system in terms of how our gut keeps things in the right place and repels those borders. But here comes the attackers. Might be the charge of the Light Brigade, a whole lot of attackers all coming at once, or it might just be a few of them. These guys. And some of these include organisms that you've probably heard of, bugs that you've heard of, like Salmonella or Shigella or Campylobacter. And Campylobacter, for example, might be through from eating chicken that hasn't been cooked properly. And these cause particular problems. Usually these are short-term problems, but all of them can upset the equilibrium, overwhelm those defences, and cause particular problems. So, I mentioned that battle is one of the themes, so we're going to talk about some particular battle scenes. This is the first one. So as you can see, this is already set up for a battle. This is Helicobacter pylori that some of you may have heard of. This is a bug that causes a whole lot of things. In this cartoon, this is Helicobacter down here, ready to attack the castle wall that is the stomach. So it lives, it goes to the stomach and lives in the lining cells of the stomach. It has a musket, it has particular toxins that it secretes and attacks the stomach wall. It also has a little shield here that's got a picture of the stomach on it. It likes to mimic the body so it can hide in the stomach without being detected by some of the body defences. This is the stomach here, flying the flag of the stomach. These little guys with the swords are particular types of white cells, helping to repel or keep that bug at bay. These guys over here are the antibody-producing cells, squirting the antibodies like arrows. This is the parietal cell, the king. This is the cell that makes the stomach acid, and it gets disrupted and damaged, doesn't work properly when Helicobacter infects the stomach. So this bug has probably been around for hundreds of thousands of years, colonising us, living in people's stomach over that time. And you may be aware of these guys, Warren and Marshall, who in 1987 first described this organism and showed that it caused gastritis, irritation of the stomach, and they went on to get the Nobel Prize more recently. So this bug is picked up in childhood. Poor sanitation is important. Overcrowding is important. So big families all living in the same room. And socioeconomic status is important as well. And it's probably spread either by gastro-oral transmission, so things coming back up again, or fecal-oral transmission, so through the poo. And this is what it causes. So in everybody that has it, you get some gastritis or some irritation of the stomach. But the bug lives there in harmony, if you like, with the immune system. So although you have those little guys with the swords and little guys with the arrows, they can't keep it at bay. They stop it causing more damage, but they can't stop it and get rid of it completely. Some people go on to get a stomach ulcer like this. And this was something that was very, very common in the past. Probably 15% get a stomach ulcer or an ulcer in the first part of the small bowel. And an even smaller number go on to get other problems like gastric cancer or lymphoma in the stomach over a lifetime of having this bug. Although we think that probably half the world's population have this bug, in our parts of the world, it's now becoming increasingly rare. And this is some data looking, this is North American, or this is American data, looking at age and what happens in terms of two different birth cohorts, showing that in young age, the rates of this bug are very, very small. People that were born in the 1920s had higher rates, but more recently, those rates are dropping. It was said late last century, and this is David Graham who wrote this, who's one of the world's experts in Helicobacter, that the only good Helicobacter is a dead Helicobacter. But there's probably emerging evidence that as we've decreased the rates of Helicobacter, as we've got rid of stomach ulcers, there's a whole lot of other problems that have emerged, and there's different strength of data for some of these things, but there's evidence suggesting that increased rates of asthma and allergies may relate to not having this bug present. Increased rates of Barrett's esophagus or reflux esophagitis may relate to not having that bug present. And obesity. This bug changes a whole lot of hormones that are involved in satiety, so how full we feel. If you don't have this bug present, you don't have the same control of ghrelin and other hormones. In inflammatory bowel disease, this bug may also be an important factor that helps to protect against getting Crohn's and colitis. So everybody that was on the earth probably had this bug. And as I said, it's been around for a long, long time. But we think we've been clever over the last 50 years, and particularly since 1987, in terms of getting rid of this bug. But there may be other consequences of that, because we're changing this balance inside the bowel. And I mentioned inflammatory bowel disease, and this is the next battle that we're going to go on and think about. So there's two different types of inflammatory bowel disease: Crohn disease, named after Burrell Crohn, and ulcerative colitis. And they affect different parts of the gut. They affect the gut in some ways the same, but in other ways differently. And this is just an example of what it can look like. So lots of ulcers, doesn't transmit that well, but lots of ulcers, and it's swollen and irritated and sore and fragile in the surface of the bowel. And this is a particularly relevant problem for Canterbury. Richard Geary's data from 5 years or so ago showed that Canterbury had one of the highest rates of Crohn disease in the world at that time. There's subsequent data that's come from Victoria that shows similarly high rates. And Richard and I have done a study over the summer with a summer student from Nelson that suggests similarly high rates in that part of the world as well. Crohn disease can occur at any age, right from the first year of life. The youngest child that I've seen was about 6 weeks of age, right to the other part of the age spectrum, right to the 90s. This is the number of people that were diagnosed at a certain age, and you can see that many people are diagnosed in this 20 to 35 age group, in this young adult group. And about 25% of the time, it's in this first decade, and children of all different ages. There's lots of data from all around the world, and this is some Australian data that I'll show you, that in children, as well as in adults, this condition's increasing dramatically. This is a study from Victoria, from Melbourne, and they showed a tenfold increase over a 30-year period, so 10 times as many children being diagnosed with these problems as there were early on in that time period. And this is another study from the same centre and from Melbourne in Australia, and they showed a dramatic increase in ulcerative colitis over a 60-year period, but almost all of that 11-fold difference happened in the last decade. So it's been increasing over time, but dramatically over the last decade. And if we looked in Canada, if we looked in many other places around the world, we're going to see the same pattern. And if we looked in adult populations, increasing dramatically as well in almost every country where it's been looked at in terms of patterns over the last few decades. In addition, since the turn of the century, more and more studies showing that this is present in Taiwan and China and Vietnam and other countries where this was thought to be non-existent and didn't happen. So something's changed, something's happening in terms of why this condition's becoming more common. We understand that these things are the key things in terms of why someone gets Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disease. The bacteria are important, and we'll talk more about them in a minute. The genetics are important, and there's now more than 130 genes that are being identified as being risk factors for why someone might get this condition. And the immune response, particularly the innate immune response, many of those factors that I mentioned earlier in terms of how the bowel protects itself can go astray. This is one example, one little cartoon, just to illustrate the connection between these three things. Just to orientate you, this is the lining cells of the gut over here. This is the lumen where things go speeding on past. And this is inside the what's called the lamina propria, beneath the lining cells of the gut. This little purple guy here is NOD2. And NOD2 is a protein that is a bacterial sensor. So it senses one particular product of a bacteria called muromyl dipeptide and leads on to a response, guiding the body to respond to that bacterial, the presence of that bacteria. So bacteria here, moving through the epithelial cells, moving inside here, nod to picking it up, and then leading to inflammation, leading to the body responding to that, so calling out the army, the fire brigade, the navy, anyone who wants to come and help get rid of this bacteria. But Nod2 is one of the key genes, and probably 25 to 30% of Europeans with Crohn's disease have a change in this gene, which means that they don't have that same response, which means that these pathways go astray and inflammation actually becomes much worse and out of control. So just as an illustration to tie together the connections between the bacteria, some of the immune response, and how the genes work together. So thinking a bit more in terms of the bacteria, and it's very clear that they have a whole lot of important roles. What isn't so clear, and I'll illustrate a little bit about this, is it's not quite clear whether this is just one bug, whether it's a whole lot of bugs, or it's different bugs in different people, or it's the balance between bugs in terms of some of the concept of dysbiosis, so too many bad bugs and not enough good bugs. And how do those bugs interact with the bowel and lead on to those changes? This is a list of some of the bacteria, and there's a virus at the bottom as well, that have been suggested that could be involved in the development of inflammatory bowel disease. None of these show convincing, overwhelming data at this point. So there's a number of candidates that people have looked at. What we've been focusing over the last years is the mucus layer. So this is a immunofluorescence study. This is the epithelial cells. This red layer here is the mucus layer. And just in here is a group of bacteria that live in the mucus. So we've been looking at bugs that live in the mucus in close proximity to those lining cells that might be able to set up a response that then initiates things. And we've been looking particularly at these organisms here. And these are Campylobacters, a type of Campylobacter called Campylobacter concisus. So they've got a little rod here, and they've got a little tail at the end that helps them swim through the mucus and get to the epithelial cells. So just some data, and I'll just walk you through it quickly. So this is the first study, and this is looking at biopsies taken from the surface of the gut. This is in children at the time they were diagnosed with Crohn's disease. Two-thirds of them had this bug present in those biopsies at the time of diagnosis. We looked at some other children who didn't have Crohn's disease, who had other problems, and they were present in 20 or 30%. So two or three times more common to have this bug living in the surface of the bowel at the time of diagnosis. We looked at the stool as well, collected stool samples, and then isolated the DNA, and then did the molecular test to see if there was evidence of this bug being present. Again, about two-thirds of the time it was present. In the control groups, it was present in about a third of the time, so about double if we looked at the stool. So very clear data, and this is just a sample of that, showing that this bug can be present at the time of diagnosis of Crohn's disease in children. Doesn't mean that it causes it, but it was present at the time of diagnosis. Just to illustrate that this isn't just a phenomenon in the down under part of the world, this is some data from Scotland, and this is looking at adults with ulcerative colitis. Same sort of conditions, adults newly diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, and they look to see if these organisms were present or not. And I'll just refer you to this middle one here. This is the concisus. So three or four times more likely to find this organism present in adults at the time of the onset of ulcerative colitis compared to controls. So this bug seems to be, whether it's just hanging around as a bad smell or whether it's just a bystander or whether it's contributing. And we went to try and understand this a little bit more. And again, just to continue the battle theme, we wanted to see, did these strains isolated from children with Crohn's disease, did they attack the lining cells of the gut? Did they invade the lining cells of the gut? And did that set up a response in terms of how the body responded to that? And I won't go through the methods too much in terms of the details. This is just summarising the data. So this is just to see how many of these organisms stuck to the lining cells and attached themselves to the lining cells of the gut. and roughly 4.5% compared to 1.6 and 0.1%, so more than 40 times more likely to bind than some of the standard strains that we'd used in the comparison. Down the bottom is a Salmonella strain, and we use that as the positive control because we know that that bound onto these particular cells. And next we looked at invasion. So between 0.2 and 0.4% of the time, these bugs got into the cells. And that may not sound very much, but in our control bugs, this was the percentage. So 1,000 times more likely, these bugs were 1,000 times more likely to invade and get inside the lining cells that were used for these experiments. And further experiments showing that they then set up a response from the lining cells. So these bugs are different from the standard bugs in a whole lot of different ways. They live in the lower part of the gut, and they can attack and invade the lining cells of the gut. And this doesn't yet show that this is the bug causing Crohn's disease, but it suggests that it plays a fairly significant role. This is just some electron microscope, and this is just the organism here. Here's one that's half in, half out, and half into a cell, showing that it's invading, and it leads to a change that's called a ruffling effect on the host cell. So it changes the shape so that they like a sort of wave appearance across the cells. So these bugs are frequently present in people with inflammatory bowel disease. Not universally, but frequently present. It's very clear that they're different from the standard bugs, that the conscisis that we might find in the mouth or that might find in terms of a standard strain. They attack and they invade the lining cells of the gut, and they prompt the body to respond. As I've sort of intimated, we're not sure if this is a major player or the major player in the development of inflammatory bowel disease. It's too early to say that. Certainly seems to be a contributing factor. How much so, we don't know. And I mentioned earlier that briefly, the concept of dysbiosis, so an imbalance between the good guys and the bad guys of the bugs that live in the gut. And there's a number of studies that have tried to look at this in terms of IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, in terms of questioning could there be an imbalance between these bugs. And the trend in the studies that have reported this, only in adults, have suggested that this class of bacteria are less, and that these classes of bacteria, the proteobacteria and the bacteroidetes, are increased. However, these results aren't consistent in terms of different studies, and that's partly because different techniques have been used, different stages of disease compared to someone who's newly diagnosed, compared to someone who might have had disease for 10 years, different locations of disease, the impact of different treatments like antibiotics, and the different populations aren't very well standardised in terms of who they compare to. So we wanted to look in children at the time of diagnosis of Crohn's disease, and this was so just around 20 children newly diagnosed and some controls that were matched for age, and these were children that had just been diagnosed, no treatment, no other intervention, and we used one of these sequencing techniques, the high-throughput sequencing that I mentioned briefly earlier, looking at the ribosomal 16S RNA, to look at the patterns of the flora and just to illustrate the advantages over some of the existing data. These children are all newly diagnosed, no treatment, and they didn't have other factors like heart disease or other drugs for other reasons, and hopefully they weren't smoking and weren't drinking alcohol as well. And this is just to illustrate some of this data. This graph just shows the four different groups: Bacteroidetes, Firmicutes, Proteobacteria, and Actinobacteria. And this looks at the frequency with which they were present. The purple bars are the controls, and the green bars are the children with Crohn's disease. And we can see that the children with Crohn's disease have more of this type of bacteria, less of this type, and more of this type. So there's differences between those different patterns of bacteria, whether you have Crohn's disease or don't. We then looked in children in terms of how severe their disease was at that time. And this is a disease activity index called the Pediatric Crohn's Disease Activity Index. It's a composite of some blood tests, what their tummy feels like, and what symptoms they've had recently. Less than 10 is doing well and in remission, and above 30 is moderate to severe, and that's as high as it goes. And we showed that the ratio between two different groups of bacteria, the Bacteroidetes, the red squares, and the Firmicutes, the black squares, varied according to the severity of the children at that time. And in particular, the Bacteroidetes was strongly associated with disease activity. So the worse the disease, different patterns of bacteria. And if we look at the patterns in a little bit more detail, this is looking at the Bacteroidetes. We included children with mild activity and children with moderate or severe and compared to the controls. And you can see there's a difference in terms of the number of those organisms that were detected. Firmicutes, it's the reverse pattern. And proteobacteria seemed to be more prominent, detected more frequently, in those with mild disease and less in those with moderate or severe or controls. So our data adds to the literature in terms of saying that there's a big variation in people with and children with Crohn's disease at the time of diagnosis in terms of the balance of the bugs. So there is a what's called a dysbiosis or an imbalance between those bugs. And again, we don't know if this is because of inflammation or if this helps to prompt and lead to inflammation. But we can say very clearly from this and a whole lot of other data that's out there that these bugs play major roles in the development of IBD. There's a number of candidate organisms, and I've mentioned the Campylobacter consciensis that we're putting our money on at the TAB. whole series of data showing that IBD is changing in terms of the frequency, so becoming more common, and this may well relate to some of those factors in terms of how we acquire and how we develop our flora early on, whether it's antibiotic exposure, whether it's breastfeeding, or whether it's the food that we eat. There's much more that needs to be worked out in terms of answering these questions. But these are some of the key things at this point. I'm going to move on to obesity. And as I'm sure everybody knows, it's an epidemic of obesity sweeping the world, not just in adults, but also in this little 8-month-old that weighed almost 20 kilograms. and there's some developing data suggesting that the bacteria in the gut may have played some role in obesity. I don't know if we can take away eating patterns and so on completely, but there's certainly some data showing that the bacteria are important. This picture here is of a particular type of bacteria called Enterobacter cloacei. And these guys here isolated this organism from an adult. This is just from one adult who weighed 178 kilograms, so rather big. And they gave this bug to some mice. And giving that bug to the mice led to obesity, led to insulin resistance, so a pattern like type 2 diabetes or the metabolic syndrome in the mice. So that was the only change. They got the organisms from this person, gave them to the mouse, and that transformed the mouse into a different pattern. They gave this person a particular diet, and with that dietary change, the individual lost 51 kilograms over a period of time, relatively short period of time, and then they looked again to see if this organism was present, and the proportion fell from 35% of the bacterial population to 0%. This is one adult. Fairly significant changes in terms of what they've demonstrated, but it's one adult, so it's too early to say that this is the bug that causes obesity. But this and a whole lot of other data supports this premise that there's maybe particular changes in the bugs, in the bacteria in the bowel, or particular bugs that might contribute to how we respond to food, how the metabolic processes occur. Some of this other data I'll just mention briefly. So there's a number of studies looking at antibiotics in early life. So antibiotics given to infants have led to increased risk of obesity occurring at 5 or 6 years of age, compared to antibiotics given at 5 or 6 years of age, not changing it as much. So antibiotics changing the development of the flora, different bugs growing, different bugs preferring to live there, and then changing how those bugs interact with us. I've mentioned Helicobacter already in terms of changing some of the hormones that are involved with appetite regulation, so suggesting that this bug is a good thing to have there, and that when you eliminate it, there may be unregulated appetite regulation, and that might contribute to obesity. There's also a whole series of other data looking at particular bugs, looking at the patterns of dysbiosis or the imbalance of bugs in the context of obesity, both in humans, and there's a whole lot of animal data as well showing that the bacteria are very important in terms of the development of obesity. That doesn't mean at this point that we can go and pig out if we have the right bugs, but it again is another example of how important these bacteria are that live inside us. So the gut and the bugs that live there, the trillions and trillions of bugs that live there, have up till the last few years been one of the final frontiers. Just like getting to Mars or whatever, we're only starting to understand this now. Part of that's been with new tools, new molecular tools, so we can look at those bugs that we can't culture and understand more. As I've illustrated, there's a whole heap of interest in the scientific community about how these bugs interact, how they interact with the body, and the particular problems that they might lead on to, particularly in terms of changing the bugs and opening us up to asthma and allergies or hay fever or all sorts of other things that might be seen as the modern-day epidemics. And as this impact is recognised, these guys take on an increasing relevance. And maybe we should be changing some of the way we do things in the environment as an impact, as a reflection of this. So just one further analogy. So this is actually a movie that I haven't seen, but I just want you to imagine who's in control? Who's the boss of this? Is it us standing up looking at the little bacteria? Or is it the little bacteria looking at us, controlling us? Who's the boss of us all? It might be a bit more like this, that we need to be in partnership. So the Thompson twins, we need to work in partnership with these guys inside us to get the best out of them and for them to give the best to us. So I'll leave you with the Thompson twins. Thank you very much for your attention.